Okay, good afternoon. On Thursday, I returned from leading a trade mission of 22 businesses to Mexico, Colombia, Chile and Brazil, and I had successful meetings with the presidents of those four countries. As you know, three of the four leaders I hadn't met before, and establishing personal relationships with the president of Mexico, Colombia and Brazil helps to place New Zealand firmly in their world view. All three leaders welcomed closer engagement with New Zealand and were positive about forging closer ties in areas like trade, services, investment and agriculture. Mexico, Colombia and Chile all confirmed their support for New Zealand's bid for a seat on the UN Security Council, which is a huge boost. President Hussein of Brazil was forward-leaning about Brazil's consideration of support for New Zealand, a real plus considering Brazil really gives away its voting preferences, so that was one of the highlights of the trip. President Santos said Colombia was ready to negotiate an FTA with New Zealand, which is an agreement I'd like to see progress quickly, and one that we're starting work on. Negotiating an FTA with Colombia is useful in its own right. For example, exports of New Zealand milk powder to Colombia face a 90% tariff, compared to a 33% tariff for US milk due to the US-Colombia FTA. However, negotiating an FTA with Colombia also has a broader significance. It would mean New Zealand would have a pathway to free trade with each of the four countries which make up the Pacific Alliance, namely Mexico, Colombia, Peru and Chile. I also met President Piñera of Chile in Santiago, where we had a good discussion about the TPP negotiations. In Chile and Brazil, we signed agreements to boost the number of students to be educated in New Zealand from secondary schools through to PhD students. In Chile, the economy minister announced an extension of the Penguins Without Borders scheme, which could bring up to $7.5 million per annum in export earnings for New Zealand secondary schools. And in Brasilia, President Hussein and I witnessed the signing of an agreement which will see New Zealand participate in Brazil's Science Without Borders program, which should see an increase in the number of Brazilian students who study in New Zealand. The 22 companies travelling with me found the visit to be extremely useful, with new business being written and new relationships being formed. By way of example, Education New Zealand finalised a $2.5 million contract for Colombian PhD students to study in New Zealand. Air New Zealand Gas Turbines received a purchase order for engine overhauls in Colombia. From agri-tech to education to specialised technology, the New Zealand businesses came away with a strong interest in their products and services. A survey done near the end of the visit showed that 22 companies who had over 130 individual meetings and garnered 49 leads, which held a strong potential for concluding new business. There was real excitement about the opportunities the Latin American countries held for New Zealand businesses. The growing middle class and spending power in these countries are translating into demand for hiring specialised services and products which our businesses are well placed to tap into. New Zealand's branding in Latin America is strong. It was noteworthy that in each country my counterparts remarked positively on New Zealand's strong commitment to the values of democracy, human rights and the rule of law. There was also strong interest, particularly in Chile, about our approach to public policy issues and how the Crown and iwi relationships function. Earlier today, Health Minister Tony Ryle announced work will commence on the first stage of the redevelopment of Christchurch's hospital in the next few months. Cabinet has agreed to set aside $500 million for this project, making it the largest and most complex building project in the history of New Zealand's public health service. The total cost of the project is expected to be more than $600 million. Work is expected to commence in June this year, with site work clearance for new facilities at Burwood Hospital. Construction for both hospitals is being fast-tracked. For Burwood, construction contracts will be awarded by Christmas, with work to begin early next year and completion in 2015. Christchurch Hospital is due to be completed in 2018. The redeveloped Burwood and Christchurch Hospitals will together have 938 beds, an increase of 159 and 8 extra new operating theatres. This is another exciting step forward in the rebuild and recovery of the Greater Christchurch region following the earthquakes, which is one of the National League Government's four main priorities for the term. It's also a good example of the Future Investment Fund, which is the proceeds of the mixed ownership model being applied to an important asset in Christchurch. On Friday, I'll be hosting the Thailand Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra at the start of her three-day visit on Friday. This is the first visit the Prime Minister Yingluck has made to New Zealand since taking office in 2011. Thailand and New Zealand share close ties. We have a strong trading relationship with good trade doubling since the closer economic partnership between our two countries was brought into force in 2005. I'm looking forward to discussing with Prime Minister Yingluck how we can leverage opportunities to build off this solid foundation, as well as talking about other issues of mutual interest. In terms of the House this week, the government intends to continue the appropriation bill and progress the minimum wage starting out amendment bill, student loan amendment bill, and the local electoral amendment bill number 2, and the marine legislation bill. Finally, in terms of ministerial activity, I'll be in Wellington obviously today, tomorrow and Wednesday. On Thursday I'm off to Taranaki, opening the new peaker plant for Todd Energy, and on Friday, as I mentioned, I'll be in Auckland, amongst other things, with the Thai Prime Minister. Questions?
What happened with the car park tax? Did National essentially say that they'd done the modest tax?
No, the Minister came to Cabinet today to give us an update of the situation. What happened was that he had sought both further advice from his own officials about the likely compliance costs, and had taken some soundings, I think, from the submissions that had gone to the Select Committee. What's fair to say is that the conclusion that he reached and Cabinet agreed with was that while there's likely to be some revenue for the Crown, and while it's quite clear that there's unfairness in the way the law currently is applied, that the compliance costs, while not nearly probably as significant as the estimations that the Select Committee had, would still put some burden on the private sector, and on balance it probably wasn't worth progressing. No, that's not true. What happened was the policy was, as part of the IRD's looking, or IRD's approach of both base broadening and looking at equity within the system. Actually, there's lots of examples of where we do that. That followed the normal standard track, which was there was a discussion document that was put out. I might add that virtually nobody actually raised any of the concerns through the submission process, and ultimately so it went to the Select Committee. We were obviously aware that there would be some impact, and we were interested in the submissions that came about as a result of that. But look, in the end, we're always going to test the boundary sometimes on some issues. There was very little pushback through the discussion process, a bit more pushback in the Select Committee, and probably on balance it wasn't worth the revenue we'd get.
And so what's the advice on the compliance costs, and how did it compare to that $30 million estimate from?
About a tenth was the initial advice, so not $30 million, maybe $3 million. But what the officials said was that it's very subjective. So look, it could be a bit more. It was hard for them to absolutely know. But if you took the view and said, look, it's not $30 million, maybe it's not $3 million, maybe it's $6 or $7, it's all very subjective. In the end, you said, well, you raised $17 million. If you put $7 million or some other number like that cost on the private sector, net on that probably wasn't worth it.
Are we going to have this debate about dealing with smartphones and laptops?
It sounds like we are. Again, they're going through a process of consultation, but what I would say is that no decision's been made about whether that's going to progress. They're simply just having that that debate, I guess, with the sector at the moment.
Businesses argue that these little taxes coming on here and there are disruptive. I mean, they just want a simple system.
Well, we have an incredibly simple system, and that's the point, isn't it? I mean, we have broad-based, low rate. And in fact, what we've been doing is simplifying the tax system since we've been in office. That was really the purpose of dropping the top personal rate and other rates and aligning them with the trust rate and the likes. I mean, this is a government, if you look at the base broadening issues, firstly, IRD's job is to look at fairness. And actually, there's quite a strong argument that if you pay FBT for an off-premises car park and you don't pay one for an on-premises car park, there's a degree of unfairness about that. The second thing is that we make lots of changes over time. So we've made them to thin capitalisation rules and all sorts of other tax rules around depreciation. Sometimes we look at things and on balance decide it's not worth it. We effectively did that when we gave up the revenue for gift duty, for instance, where we were getting some revenue but on balance decided it wasn't worth it for the compliance costs. So this was one of those ones which was a bit more at the edge. And when the discussion document went out, we expected a bit more pushback. It never came. And so I think the view was, well, maybe it's less significant than people thought. But, you know, the government lives in an environment where there is no real extra cash. And we have, over the course of the last 4 years, spent a lot of new money in certain places and had to raise it in others. And we're constantly changing that mix. Now, that's the world that we inherited, where there's not a lot of cash around. So we always have to test the boundaries. And looking at the FBT application for on-premise car parks was just one of, quite frankly, hundreds of changes that we look at over the course of time.
Were there any political considerations in this decision? For example, your report promised back in 2005 that the government, that your party wouldn't do this?
No, I mean, but look, at the end of the day, what I actually highlighted in that speech was the very point that sort of came to light, which is my concern wasn't that we're opposed to FBT, actually, largely been in favour of FBT. What I was worried about was unnecessary compliance costs. Now, you know, when you, that was made three elections and nearly 9 years ago, and I'm prepared to accept that in opposition, sometimes you don't have all of the information that you have in government, and so the officials had over a period of time put up a case that said actually it wouldn't, compliance wouldn't be that great, or at least there would be, you know, some merit in fairness of the argument. Over time things do evolve. But, you know, my view on balance was the minister made the right recommendation for the revenue versus the compliance cost. It wasn't worth progressing it further.
What do you make of David Shearer producing a bank account
in
the United Nations
for money? Look, I just don't have any details on that. It's a matter for him, and that's why we're keenly interestless.
What did you think of the Auckland Council's draft unitary plan? Do you think it will do the job of building all these houses that Auckland needs?
I'm not convinced that it'll solve all of the issues. And as you can see, there's quite a bit of debate about actually how much available is really there. I think the unitary plan would certainly help, and the government's supportive of moving that process through faster. The one difference is, of course, the council wants us to approve the plan and fast track it for implementation in September. And our view is that there should be at least some capacity for the community to have some input about aspects of that plan. There's also a few technical issues about exactly whether, even if we were to fast track it, whether what that would mean under notified RMA consent. So look, in the end, we're moving towards the best compromise I think we can, which is at least some capacity for input to the community, but a much, much speedier implementation of that plan.
Do you share the Reserve Bank government's concerns that we face a housing bubble?
Well, we've seen house prices rise and probably a little faster than we'd all be comfortable. And if we take a step back and say, why is that? I do believe it's been a combination of lack of supply of land and actually lack of investment. I mean, there were a lot of property developers that were badly hurt as a result of the 2008 crash. So it was natural that there would be a void in the market. I mean, what is true, and the Reserve Bank Governor said, I mean, that these very low interest rates actually, for all the arguments about housing affordability, actually are allowing a lot of people to get into the housing market because they can afford to pay their mortgage and they have had the capacity to get into the housing market. So I think, given he's signalling that interest rates are likely to be low for quite a long period of time, the government does need to look at all the levers around housing to make sure that there's enough supply to ensure that there isn't, you know, a runaway housing market. Because one thing I do know is that if you have a bubble in your housing market, long term that's really bad for your economy. That is one of the major issues that had a massive impact on the US economy. And we can't put that in New Zealand.
You will use you make sure those prudential tools are used if we get into a bubble like scenario?
Well, what I'd say is that he's got to go through that process, and that's what he's doing. He's going through a discussion document, I think, about those at the moment. And look, as a kind of banker, I could take a step back and tell you, look, there might be ways to get around those rules. So I don't think anyone's absolutely buttoned down that they will work, because we've seen these types of controls before, and there are always ways of getting around them. But what I do really share the Governor's view on is that he is trying to protect the health of the banking system in New Zealand, and that is absolutely critical. The one thing that's got New Zealand, Australia and Canada through the global financial crisis more than anything else has ultimately been that our banking system wasn't as badly affected as those other countries. So I think the Governor is actually doing his job, standing up saying, look, I might just need more tools and be able to make sure that the quality of the banking system remains intact and has integrity.
So you get worried that some of the banks could try and get around it, like they did with the mortgage rules, say, back in 2003 or whatever, where they basically ignore what the Reserve Bank was trying to do, might try and circumvent these prudential tools.
Well, it's always possible, isn't it? I mean, I don't spend my day trying to work out how to do that, but I'm just saying that if you limit loan-to-value ratios, then by definition, you could, you know, the quaint notion is that people will save the balance, but it might be that they look to another financial institution or start borrowing from their lawyer or some other mechanism for doing that. That's what he needs to, I think, test out when he goes through this consultation process of how likely is it that they'll actually work, and what will it mean for credit, for instance, in the SME sector that relies on borrowing against their home, for instance. There's a number of factors he needs to test out, but personally he has my support that at least he's looking at those issues, because as I said, I think it's critical for the functioning of a strong country that your banking system has integrity.
So would you be comfortable if the Reserve Bank said, let's limit loan-to-value ratios at 90%, which a lot of first-time buyers will find?
If in the end, as a result of his analysis, and he believed it was the right thing, I think the government will look very, very closely at it.
Are we going to see anything come out in terms of documentation that shows material differences in agreement between Solid Energy and the government? Because all we've really seen so far is that the government wanted more difference.
I don't think that is right as an analysis. I think what you've seen is there was quite a lot of, there's a significant difference in the not so much the, well, I think you can say the significant difference in the direction that the company wanted to take Solid Energy and the government's belief in that. I mean, in the end, as you saw from the documents we released on Friday, they ultimately wanted to have a $27 billion investment in a natural resources company, and the government's view was that didn't work for us. So I don't think you can say we're in agreement in all things along the way. There was agreement in some areas, but not in others.
But will we see further disagreement? Because, I mean, Tom McGough praised the vision and said, not quite as far as you want to go, still going to lignite.
Well, there's nothing new in terms of the lignite and, biofuels and the other areas that they went into. That started well before National, didn't it? It started right back in 2003. And so there's a range of views there about the merits. Some people like some bits of it more than others. There is quite a substantial difference between that, though, and a natural resources company that's capitalised to the order of $27 billion.
And why can't we have an inquiry? It seems like
this. I'm not sure it would achieve a lot, really. I mean, what... I think we have a pretty clear view of what's gone on at Solid Energy and why. I mean, I think part of what Don Elder says is actually right. I mean, the company has suffered from significant deterioration in coal prices. It's also suffered from some investments that just simply didn't work out. And as a result of that, it's now in the position it's in, where the government's having to work with the bankers to try and find a way through for Solid Energy. I don't think there's anything magical there. I mean, in the end, they had a pretty significant build-up in their overhead structure. That's well documented. They made some investments that didn't work out in non-core assets. That's very well documented. They made some investments in core assets, like Spring Creek, that didn't work out. Well, that's pretty well documented. And the coal price collapsed. That's well documented. And there's nothing magical at Solid Energy, just lots of things went wrong all at the same time.
It seems like a pretty high-risk strategy, no currency hedging, only short-term contracts, even though they thought they were
in a
bull market?
Well, all of those things in the end are operational matters, and that's been the point I've been making. I mean, you can run around in circles trying to point fingers, but if National's to blame, then so is Labor. I'm sorry, but in the end, the issues of investments and the direction of the company are actually set by the management and board. It's the management and the board that are responsible for the structure of the balance sheet. It's the management and the board that are responsible for the investment decisions that are made. And in the end, they made those operational decisions. Now, it would be... Some of the arguments I've seen in the last couple of days are ridiculous. They're the arguments based on the fact that if a public company went broke, it's the shareholders that are responsible. Well, I just don't see it that way.
So in 2011, that scoping report, that threw out some problems.
Yeah.
That was when you also went into the election campaign saying you're going to sell Solid Energy amongst those other SOEs that you were going to float. Should you have perhaps flagged then that Solid Energy might not be a
government? No, and I think the reason for that is that there was... I guess the hope that, well, firstly, there was quite a bit of debate between the company and the government about the merits of the scoping study. It's fair to say that the government put a lot of credence in that report and the company didn't so much. Secondly, some of it was subjective, so it was, you know, the company had a very different price path and had low levels of proven reserves, but was working on those, the second issue, and disagreed with the government on the piece. So, I mean, I guess my view would be that was always, as soon as we got that scoping study, I think we were always of the view it would mean that solar energy certainly wouldn't be at the front of the queue in terms of being part of the mixed ownership program, but there was always a hope that they would be able to get there and resolve some of their issues and a focus on their core assets.
So
my other
thing is that
I don't think so, really. I mean, firstly, by then anyway, we'd already said 5 to 7 billion. So, I mean, you've got to remember the sequence of events were that we gave the speech in the early part of 2011 saying this was our program, and these were the likely candidates that were involved, and this is the likely amount of money that would be released. We then commissioned the scoping studies on all of the four SOEs, and it was only by the time we got that back that we realised, well, there's some issues there. It's still very unclear about whether we'll get 5 to 7 billion, even if solar energy was never part of the program. We may easily achieve that, we may not. Let's know after we've gone through the first SOEs.
What month did you receive the solar energy scoping study?
I don't know, that's my office.
So
I don't have that team.
Sorry? Earlier,
2011 rather than. I can't remember the time. I think it's more the latter part of the year, but I might be wrong. You just didn't check my office.
And were you able to release that?
Sorry? I don't know. We need to check that we're able to do that, I suppose, and you know, commercial sensitivities might be in there. But I mentioned some part of that report would be able to come out. I mean, it was certainly highly critical, is the way I would describe it.
What will you lose by holding a solar committee warrant? What's the cost here? It doesn't sound like a particularly high cost process.
Well, I guess the other side of looking, way of looking at it is what would be to gain.
Well, this is a major corporate collapse public accountability.
Well, there is public accountability. I don't think you necessarily get that just because you have a select committee inquiry.
Would the government have to cut spending to offset the effects of the drought and still get to its surplus target?
Again, too early to tell what the implications will be. I mean, you've seen the Minister of Finance saying that it's in the order of $1 to $2 billion, the early estimates. I think what's fair to say is that they're quite subjective at the moment. So there's been some talk out of Treasury that it could cost about 0.7% of GDP, which is about $1 to $1.5 billion. But everyone will admit that it depends on how much it rains, it depends how many farmers have managed to keep their herds still milking. It depends on quite a number of factors. So the other thing is that the important point I reckon to remember is that if you put the enormous cost to one side that's had the impact on farmers, you've got to look and say, okay, if the economy loses $1 billion, let's say, how much does that reduce our tax revenue? And then how much of that might be offset by increased revenue in other areas? For instance, we know that other parts of the economy have been producing more tax revenue than we thought. So net on net, whether it actually has an impact on our capacity to get back to surplus is very unknown at this point, but not at all clear that it necessarily will.
Will you know before the budget?
Don't know. Well, I guess they'll obviously have to have the most up-to-date numbers when they go into the budget, but whether they'll be able to successfully impact the drought by then, I don't know. There'll certainly be an estimate in there.
But you're not going into the budget process thinking we have to find some savings here?
No, not at the moment, no.
Is the government any closer to a target on emissions for
2020? No, we haven't. I mean, the Minister's been away overseas, as you probably aware, he's travelling fairly extensively on the WTO bit at the moment. But you know, he'll come back in the fullness of time, we'll make sure that we've set that target.
How was that WTO
picked up? Too early to tell, I think. He's up against good candidates. When we raised the issue everywhere we went, but there's obviously quite a number of Latin American candidates, and I think there's 7 in total, that sort of number. So it's always going to be a long shot, simply because it's a very political process. There's lots of particular candidates there, but as I say to all the leaders and anyone else that will listen, if you want my view, Tim Grosser has the best skills and the best capability, can bring the best capability to the job, and I hope he's successful.
Did Canada discuss an overpay and were your decisions made about where to from here?
Yes, it discussed an overpay, and I think Minister Joyce will be in a position to give you a much fuller update on what happens next this week.
But any decisions about whether to keep the standalone system or?
Rather than for me to sort of wander down that path today, maybe I'll just leave it to him, because he's going to be in a position to talk about the technical review and other things with you, to say, this week.
Can I just ask you about the Christchurch Hospital announcement?
Yes.
Are you able to say what the plans are for Princess Margaret Hospital? Because it looks like that might cross over some of the new plans.
No, if you'd like to ask Tony about that, I think. Okay. See you later.